Okay, thanks a lot for letting me do this. After this discussion session this morning, I sort of came back to my office and looked out of the window, and I thought, gee, I must be completely insane to do this. Because,
thanks for keeping
sure. I'm going to talk to these people about things that nobody agree on. So, but anyway, it's a little bit like...
Are there testable consequences?
I don't know yet. Okay, so this is very much a work in progress that was almost entirely done while Zlatko and I were here at ITP. And for that reason, some of the results, or most of them, are sort of everything is in flow and in the process, and I very much welcome your comments. What I'm going to tell you today is summarized in this first graph. And the main result is something like this. When you take a plain vanilla D-wave BCS superconductor, and D-wave in this sense is essential, and you disorder it by vortex, anti-vortex fluctuations, what you get is a marginal Fermi liquid with a little star on it. So for the most part, what we get for phenomenology of these fermionic excitations is like marginal Fermi liquid with some important differences, which actually make it, I think, fit better the available experimental data.
And you're thinking about at zero temperature?
I'm thinking at finite temperature, crossing over to pseudo-gap regime at finite temperature. okay, so as a cartoon, what we have, and Matthew Fisher discussed this in the morning very eloquently, in the superconducting state, the vortex-antivortex excitations are bound, and we have a Fermi liquid. This is an empirical fact, and we understand that theoretically within the framework of BCS theory. Above critical temperature, the vortices unpair, and we have a soup of fluctuating vortex-antivortex pairs, which are unbound, and in some sense, they're some branch cuts in between them, and I will specify that in a moment what I mean. And I will show you that this has a property of marginal Fermi liquid. So why would anyone think about vortices in this context? First, there is a conceptual issue, which is that we know that the under superconducting dome, we have a well-defined quasi-particle. I think almost nobody will argue with that. And the particle-like, other particle-like excitations are vortices. So we may as well try, if we're lucky, to describe the pseudo-gap phase as phase disordering this nice D-wave superconductor, because we think we understand it quite well. And it all started experimentally by work of Uemura, who measured this famous dependence of critical temperature in the underdoped, which is proportional to superfluid density, and from that he argued that the transition at TC in the underdoped is a phase disordering or phase ordering transition, if you wish, rather than amplitude going to zero. And more modern version of this graph is here. I took it from a recent preprint that Uemura has on the web, where the conclusion seems to be the same, except that there is more compounds being tested. Now even C60 falls on this line, although I'm not going to address that. Now, there is more evidence for vortices, as you well know, and I go through that quickly. There is a famous set of experiments by Joe Ernstein's group where they see evidence for phase stiffness at short length scales at some temperature above TC. So this is the extrapolated phase unbinding temperature, and in 74 degree Kelvin at 90 Kelvin, they still see a signature of this effect, although then it dies down in the noise. And more recently, in neutron scattering in magnetic field, Dai et al., this is Mook's group, also seem to see some evidence for vortices above TC. Although, again, one may dispute how far this goes, but there seems to be some evidence that this effect is real. Finally, the strongest evidence comes from thermal transport, and this is Ong's results on LFCO, where he argues that his sensitivity is the best to this effect, and he sees evidence for some vortex, for presence of vortices up to fairly high temperature in LFCO. Now, I have a preprint which unfortunately I am not allowed to show you, but perhaps I'm allowed to quote it from the same group, which says that the same effect they observe in MyBCO and BISCO. And this will appear on the web hopefully very soon. So the tentative picture that...
What are those lines?
Okay, these are the lines of... so the argument is that in a superconductor, the Nernst effect is big because there are vortices which carry entropy. On the other hand, in normal state, Nernst effect is typically small. And
why is that?
Why is that?
It's in the Fermi liquid in a non-interacting system somehow, right?
It's a theoretical fact and empirical fact. Ong tells me that...
Empirical fact that it is not.
Yeah, above that upper line, it's small.
Right.
In most other substances, which are not high TC superconductors, this effect is small above critical temperature or in the metallic state because of so-called Sonheimer cancellation. And what Ong finds is that above TC, in these materials, this effect is big. Basically, there's no significant difference going from superconducting to normal state.
What are the numbers exactly on the Nernst lines?
I just want to know, their contour is a constant Nernst.
They are contour of constant Nernst coefficient, okay. If you wish. Yes. And so at this point, again, they lose their signal. This is not to say that the effect ends here. It could persist to higher temperature. There's just sensitivity of the equipment is at its limit.
Another question is that in all these experiments like Wernstein and this, the lines of onset of whatever, they're all different, right?
They're all different, and I'm going to comment on that.
Okay.
So the model or the scenario that we're going to discuss here is the following. You have a D-wave superconductor, and this transition in the underdoped we declare is a phase disordering transition, vortex, anti-vortex pairs unbind, and then we make an ansatz that this area of the phase diagram is dominated by fermionic coupling to these vortex, anti-vortex fluctuations. Now, there's in my mind two distinct possibilities. I think there is no question that there is some region here above TC where these vortex, anti-vortex fluctuations exist. Now, there's two possibilities. One is that these are completely irrelevant and they are just a complication, and the pseudo-gap physics is due to something completely else. And in that case, what I'm going to talk about today is not relevant to cuprates. Now, another possibility is that in this region, the vortex, anti-vortex fluctuations and their coupling to fermions is what really gives you, say, the spectral function with a pseudo-gap and are dominant players in the physics. Now, in that case, notice that there's no reason to draw a line like this, because in experiments, as Ilya pointed out, every experiment shows this line dying down somewhere else, and that dying down of signal is basically because the experiments are at their resolution limit. And that is not to say that the effect is not present, it's just it's not detectable anymore. So it's a point of logic, but if you assume that phase fluctuations are important here, then I see no reason to say that suddenly they become unimportant over here and the pseudo-gap physics is due to something completely different.
Yes. Go ahead.
Well, my question was, marginal Fermi liquid physics is seen way above the pseudo-gap region. In fact, it's better outside the pseudo-gap region than inside. So the marginal Fermi liquid behavior you're going to talk about is a different kind of marginal Fermi liquid behavior, or are you claiming it also applies to the region above the pseudo-gap?
All I'm saying is that when one takes this model in the pseudo-gap region, one gets the marginal Fermi liquid behavior. So this model does not apply in this normal phase, at least not in this form. And you know, I'm fully aware of that point. On the other hand, I will show you some data in ARCAS which seem to indicate such behavior in this pseudo-gap phase. Yes?
Coincides with the going out of the normalized classical regime for this pairing fluctuation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not an an accident or saying they run out of the solution. I mean, there may be a piece of physics there. The other comment is that the T star, in at least in night shift and in resistivity, and not NMR actually, but there's a number of experiments which would give basically the same.
Same T star.
You cannot say that all experiments give different.
Okay, but T star and the line at which there ceases to be any evidence for vortices might be different, right?
Right.
Yeah. So that's all I'm saying.
Just in terms of the terminology, I guess the and the moment you don't have supergravity, you of course have solved phase fluctuations.
Yes.
So what am I supposed to make of that line?
This line?
No. Beyond this.
This line.
Right.
I just argue to you that no such line actually exists. This is a line in the second scenario that I'm talking about, where experiments stop seeing effects of vortex-anti-vortex fluctuations for whatever reason that they run out of resolution, for instance. So, for as an example, if I look at Ong's data, then you know. This is what he sees. This is where he runs out of resolution, and he has to draw some line here. But that's not to say that above that line, suddenly physics is completely different.
You should be thinking of your shaded region as a region where the phase fluctuations are becoming less rapid. Okay. So it's going towards.
Yes. Okay. Strictly speaking, this shaded region is a region in which I think there is very solid evidence that there are phase fluctuations from number of experiments. And then this dotted region is perhaps a region where there is less.
It's slower in that region than outside of that region.
Yeah. We can put it this way.
It's longer exactly.
In that region.
So do you envision a dilute gas of vortices? What is the concentration of vortices?
Okay, that's a good question, and I'm not aware of any estimates on that. It's dilute enough so that cores do not overlap. On the other hand, it cannot be completely diluted. There has to be enough vortices to affect a quasi-particle behavior almost everywhere. So I'm going to argue that the destruction of coherence peaks in, say, ARPES is due to proliferation of these vortex-anti-vortex pairs. So there has to be enough of them. In other words, the theory that I'm going to talk about is valid at length scales larger than typical intervortex separation. So for that reason, I need this density to be substantial, but you know, not large enough to everything be a core.
It's not a concern of quantities, it's a little delta triangle, right? Some of the positive and negative circulation vortices is not a concern of quantity.
Well, on average, it's still
not. It depends on average. It depends
on
that. Okay, so we're not the first to.
If you are well isolated.
No,
if it's dilute, then you can define it. Well, you can count the core.
Well, yeah, I would agree with that. I mean,
no, there'll be some that, you know, there'll be virtual pairs that are, you know, how do you decide when
they're separated?
Yeah.
Be in, say, 3 or 4 times TC and not have the vortices be pretty dense.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so you see, I'm well aware of all these objections, and I'm blindly going to proceed anyway, and there's some nice physics hidden there, and we can then decide whether it's relevant to cuprates or it's completely irrelevant. But you know, I'd like to share this with you and get some comments. So this approach is not new, and perhaps the first to notice this nice physics based on work of Uemura and others was Emery M. Kivelson, who shortly thereafter converted to the dark side and started discussing everything in terms of stripes, which is slightly different physics and beautiful in its own. Andy Millis and myself, and shortly thereafter, Leon Belenz, Matthew Fisher, and Chetan Nayak did something along the lines that I'm going to discuss today.
Wait, the things in parentheses are what the paper is not about?
I'm saying shortly thereafter. Right? Well, these two approaches are considered precisely the scenario that I have in mind at the moment.
The color makes the difference.
Okay. So
red devil.
That is bad.
So the approach that Andy Millis and I took was very simple, semi-classical treatment of these vortex-anti-vortex fluctuations, which is probably completely wrong, but has the advantage that one can calculate everything. And all these people then followed and used similar approach to calculate various other quantities. And I apologize if I left someone out. There's lots of papers using this approach out there. The local group here at Santa Barbara, their approach is probably correct, but the disadvantage is that you cannot really calculate anything, as far as I can see, except for making bold statements. Yeah, and that's not criticism. The summary is here that the most previous work uses this semi-classical Volovic Doppler shift approximation. In the present work that I'm going to talk about today, we identify additional purely quantum mechanical interaction between quasi-particles and vortices, which then leads to this marginal Fermi liquid behavior. And at this point, I unfortunately have to go a little bit technical because I have not yet figured out the way how to describe this physics in terms of pictures and slogans. But for the most part, this is actually very easy quantum mechanics. So we start from a partition function describing a D-wave superconductor with phase being a dynamical fluctuating variable. We have Grassmann variables describing our fermions. Hamiltonian is just that of a D-wave superconductor with kinetic energy, Fermi energy here, and the pairing function has this complicated form. This is anti-commutator or symmetrization between momentum operator and the gap, and this is what gives you the D-wave structure of the order parameter in the real space. This piece here is needed to preserve gauge invariance. Now, for S-wave superconductor, this delta would just be a constant. It's just a D-wave thing that makes this look complicated, but again, that's essential for our purposes here. Yes? No, this is not semi-classical, this is fully quantum mechanical.
So the delta quantum mechanical field?
No.
How do you write this?
The amplitude of the gap is constant. Phase is assumed to have quantum mechanical fluctuations.
So delta of R is some magnitude times e to the alpha.
Yes, precisely. Yes, and that
P sub y means a derivative.
Yes, yes, okay, that just means derivative.
Thanks.
Okay. So this is completely.
Let me ask you one dumb trivial question.
Yes.
If you integrate out the phase.
Yes.
What kind of interaction between electrons you get?
Okay, that's what I'm going to talk about. That's what I'm going to talk about for the rest of this talk.
Because, okay.
Yeah, you just want to know right here.
You could think that the starting point could be some interacting model.
Yes.
The quartic interactions are decoupled by some field, right? Some pairing field.
Yes.
I'm trying to see if you go back to that thing, what would it be from this particular thing?
Well, you have to worry about, you see, you cannot directly integrate out that phase because it contains vortices in it. So, you can do some Gaussian integral and that would give you some quartic interaction, but that's not what we want to do. We have to consider explicitly vortices because they lead to non-trivial physics. Okay, so what we have, this is what was asked just a minute ago. We assume that the amplitude of the gap is constant everywhere and the phase is allowed to vary. And the non-trivial physics come from a phase winding by 2 pi around each vortex, or minus 2 pi around each anti-vortex. Now, well, one can also say that the gradient of phase, if you have vortices, has a global curvature. If you take a curl of a gradient, then you don't get zero, but you get a bunch of delta functions associated with vortex singularities. And notice that this statement is completely independent of what happens in the core. This is a statement of global curvature of the phase. So that does not have anything to do with the core. This delta function is there purely because of the phase winding. Now, what we need to do to make any progress on this problem is to remove the phase, these complex phases, from the off-diagonal piece of our Hamiltonian. And traditionally, what people have done in the past is to perform so-called symmetric transformation, where you take your fermion with spin up or spin down and absorb phi over 2 phase into it. And since you're in spin singlet state, that precisely cancels this piece in the off-diagonal part of the Hamiltonian. However, it was Nobel liquid people that in their second paper, I think, pointed out that this is no good, actually, because when you do this transformation in the presence of vortices, you immediately introduce branch cut in the wave function, because phi over 2 just winds by pi, and therefore you have these nasty branch cuts in the fermionic wave function, and that's no good. You somehow have to handle these. Zlatko and I then were thinking about similar problem in vortex lattice, where vortices are generated by magnetic field. And we came up with this bipartite transformation, which avoids this problem in the first place. What we do, we arbitrarily split the phase field into 2 pieces and transform spin up and spin down electrons differently. So we will have 2 phases, one with spin up, one with spin down. And as long as the sum is the total phase of the order parameter, you also remove this phase from the off-diagonal piece. But now you can do it in such a way that you do not split any single vortex into 2 pieces. So in other words, you put, when you have a vortex, you either put it in phi up or phi down, but not in both of them. And therefore, you will not have branch cuts. What you get is somewhat more complicated Hamiltonian. And
this highlight spin rotation invariance?
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. It looks like it does, but in the end, you can do it in such a way. Yeah. SU2 asymmetry is not broken. So you can think now of vortices as carrying 2 quantum numbers. One is the usual vorticity, which is a physical quantum number. And then we assign to a vortex Ising spin. So it has either spin up or spin down according to whether it's seen by spin up electron or spin down electron. So this.
But that's an unphysical.
That's an unphysical internal symmetry of the problem, but it helps us to deal with these branch cuts. In this situation, we will.
So the spin-up electrons pick up a 2 pi phase when they toss around hot
yes.
vortices and don't see the other.
Precisely. Yes. And the advantage of this is that that we can, or at least we think we can handle this in our calculation. Okay, so we just perform this transformation and turn the crank and get the transformed Lagrangian, which now contains these time, temporal, and spatial derivatives of these 2 phase fields, phi up and phi down. But the what we gained is that the off-diagonal piece here is no longer complex. This is now a real operator. Now this looks very messy. As a next step, what we do, we can write it in a more transparent way. We define a 2 new gauge fields. We define a gauge field V mu, which is just a superfluid velocity. It's associated with the sum of these 2, and this is by definition just the phase of the order parameter. So this whole thing is just a usual superfluid velocity. And the new term here is this Berry term, because these phases can be thought of as geometrical phases that electron acquires, and that's associated with a difference between the 2. And so that wouldn't be there in the theory where you do this symmetric transformation. And it's this Berry gauge field which takes care in some sense of those branch cuts that would otherwise appear in our wave functions. Okay, so upon that identification, what we get is a Lagrangian in terms of these new gauge fields, which looks something like this. And I just wanted to give you, to give it a little consideration. So what we have, again, is Lagrangian, where we have two gauge fields, and they couple differently to our momentum. So the Doppler gauge field couples as the original electromagnetic vector potential did. And that's understandable, because this is just a measurable superfluid velocity, while A couples in a different way. It couples via sigma zero, which is just a unit matrix in Nambu space, and it couples directly to the momentum. Everywhere you see momentum, there you see also this A. Okay? And now, since no and this L0 term, I will discuss it shortly, is basically a Jacobian of this transformation. We went from integration over phases to integration over these gauge fields, so we have to worry about how the measure of this functional integral changes, and I will discuss that in a second. Now, since no theory these days can attract attention without inventing some new names, I will refer to these transformed fermions as topological fermions, because we transformed away this topological phase, and I will refer to quanta of this A nu field, this Berry field, as vortex baryons.
Yes? It looks like the same thing as a spin mass.
Okay. At this stage, you're right, but we're now going to sum over all of these realizations of that transformation.
Psi is charge neutral.
Yeah, psi is charge neutral. Yes, yes, because we transformed away the we shielded it with a superflow. Pardon me?
It's another part due to the vortex moving, right?
This one?
Depends on phi, not just A. Because vortex are also moving around.
Well, at this point, we're just considering classical fluctuations, so we don't worry about that. Yes, in general, you will have some Berry phase term like that, yeah. But we do not consider that at the moment.
Well,
yes.
Go back to your definition of phase.
Yes?
No.
when you drag a psi up around the vortex, does it pick up any phase?
You drag a psi around the vortex.
You pick up phase from half the vortices. So in what sense is it uncharged?
Yeah, that's why. I'm saying that it's not quite like spin-on. And that's why we invented this name, topological fermion.
It's charge neutral.
No, in terms of physical electromagnetic charge, is it charged or charge neutral?
It is charge neutral.
It's both. It's neutral, but it's got odd charge.
That's
okay, but he probably wants to...
Except for phase as it goes around. It's charge neutral with respect to external magnetic field, but the carry charge to the internal field. That's the same with spin-up. It's charge neutral spin-up. It carries internal charge, but no external charge.
So it doesn't carry any electromagnetic charge?
No.
Okay. That must be really about the branch cut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this by definition there is no branch cuts, because I just don't allow them to happen. I never put this factor of 1/2 anywhere.
Marcel, since they stopped you, I want to ask a question also.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could have done this by just putting all the phase into the up electrons.
Yes,
then you
I could.
Get rid of your branch cuts.
Yes, 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 yes.
Why is that not a good thing?
Because that would correspond to overall magnetic field that fermions would see.
No, that's just a transformation. That's exact also.
But you see, all these transformations, if I could solve the problem exactly, would lead to precisely the same answer.
Right.
The problem is I have no idea how to solve this problem exactly.
Uh-huh.
And that's why I just do all of these transformations and I restore the symmetry by summing over them.
Steven. What you said is exact, is correct, but the point is how to make a good limpid theory.
No, I understand.
Yeah. So
what do you think
Steve
is exact?
Steve has been down this road.
What?
Steve has been down this road.
Yeah, and you see, plus such configuration where all of these spins are just up, in some sense, if you summed over all of them, is extremely unlikely. right? If I would sum over all of these configurations, the maximum weight would be a dose where there's exactly as many up as there is down vortices. That's the point. But you're absolutely right. I mean, if we're able to exactly solve the problem, we could, we need not bother with this in the first place. We could just solve the phase windings in the first place, right? So one thing that is a little ugly, but I have to face it now, is how to deal with this L0. This is my Jacobian of transformation, or my measure when I go from integration over phases to integration over over my gauge fields. And it has this form, so I have to perform this integral. And actually, although it looks very ugly, after some agonizing steps, one can actually calculate this exactly in saddle point approximation. And leaving long wavelength approximation, one gets this very simple result in for thermal fluctuations in a two-dimensional system. So it's just a curl of V plus curl of A squared, just a Maxwellian term.
By sum of over sigma, you mean summation over the various...
By sum of sigma in curly brackets, I mean summation over all possible up and down configurations. Yes. So the point is to make this symmetry of Lagrangian explicit.
Does sigma depend on time or not?
Pardon me? No. That does not depend on time. Why? Okay.
You see, sum before
just a gauge choice. How can depend on?
No,
there are other things that depend on that choice.
No. They are not. The rest of the Lagrangian does not depend on the choice of sigma. The rest of the Lagrangian just contains V mu and A mu as a dummy variables over which I'm integrating. So I think this is
okay.
Correct. Yes.
I want to say here you take A as a U1 field.
Yes.
The continuous field. Actually the Z2 field. So actually what I said is if you integrate it out you do not get this Maxwell term. Only when you approximate by U1 field
yes.
you get a Maxwell term. Actually it is a Z2 field.
Yes. Okay, that's a good point. So we started from something that has a phase, and a gradient of phase is just a U1 field plus a Z2 field associated with each vortex, and we end up with something that has two U1 fields. So this is a long wavelength approximation, and Jingwu is right. So we ask how one can approximate this at low energies and long wavelengths, and this is, I would claim, the most natural way to do that. So, in other words, if you assume if you decide to make that approximation, then what you find is that this is the leading stiffness of those two U1 gauge fields that you get. Yes.
This would make your sort of understanding what this entire stuff that you're doing. What you did was take a Cooper pair, take the Cooper pair operator, same suit, and formally write it as a product of an up boson and a down boson. And then write the electrons product of the up boson and up fermion. An up electron is a product of an up boson and up fermion. It's merely for a down electron.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you.
Yeah, you can think of it that way. Yeah, we didn't think of it that way. But
the Cooper pair is a product of an up boson and a down boson.
Yes, but in a very specific way. In a very specific way, where I do not fractionalize any of the vortices that exist in the phase of that Cooper pair. So I don't do that.
Fractionalizing the Cooper pair, breaking a Cooper pair into a product of two bosons, an up boson and a down boson.
No, but those the up and down bosons, their wave function is a single value.
Yes.
If they pick up, as I say, the up boson picks up a 2 pi when it goes around half of this vortices.
Yes, there are vortices in the up boson and there are vortices in the down boson.
Yeah, exactly.
Must I really want to say, because I had read this in the paper. In the U1 field, if you treat if you approximate the Z2 field by U1 field, you get very different results with Z2 and U1. U1 does not keep the periodicity of plus and minus vortices. So the real case...
No, that's not true. Look, I mean, this leading term does not depend on up or down anymore. This just depends on the average density of free vortex excitation. So if you resolve to make that approximation, then this is what you get in leading order in long wavelength approximation. And this is the problem is if you stick with vortices, then you're never going to see, you're never going to solve this problem. Pardon me?
When did you make this jump from Z2 to
Z2? No.
It popped up very quickly.
Pardon me?
This little A showed up very early. Was that an approximation?
That wasn't any approximation. Okay, so since you forced me to this discussion, I wanted to avoid this discussion. See, the point is, A is related to the difference between phi up and phi down, and V is related to their sum, right? And so both of them cannot be treated as, strictly speaking, as independent fields, because they depend on the same positions of vortices, right? So they are, strictly speaking, not independent. So to begin with, we have one phase, and we have this spin variable, Ising spin variable, sitting on each vortex. Okay. Now, what we decide to do in this, when we make this substitution and discuss the long wavelength theory, we just decide to treat these as two U1 fields. And in this L0 piece that I just derived, that will be the leading term in the action for these two U1 fields.
I would like to say, what's the interaction between these vortices?
So far, there's absolutely no interaction. This is just purely change in the measure of integration. You get interaction when you integrate out fermions, and you get logarithmic interactions. And I'm going to get to that if you let me.
What I mean, there is a term in your integration which depends on the interaction between this phi, between these vortices.
Yes, there is, but that comes purely from fermions, and I have not yet integrated out fermions.
No.
Okay, so that will come in the next transparency, Jinwoo. Please, let me just do it. Okay, so now, what Jinwoo asked me, what is the effect of fermions on these gauge fields? And in order to answer that question, this is what will give me the interaction between vortices in the original problem, and the same effect gives me the additional terms in the Lagrangian for these two gauge fields. So first thing that I notice, and it's best to just look at temporal piece of this Lagrangian, and this is just exact rewriting of that temporal piece with no approximations. I have the zero field piece here, plus I have something that couples to my Doppler gauge field, and if I look at that and write it in terms of my original electrons, this is just the charge density. So my Doppler gauge field couples to charge density, while this has sigma zero in it, and if I write it, I find that this is just a spin density. You don't have a minus sign.
Z component of the spin.
Yeah, Z component of spin density.
Where is SU2?
Well, it's just, you know, usual thing when you do BCS theory, you sort of break SU2, but it's not broken, it's just a...
That's in particle Hall space, not in the spin space. It does not break spin SU2.
It does not. You see, when you do normal BCS theory, you pair spin up and spin down electrons, so it's like you're breaking SU2 theory, but you're not really doing that, it's just a formalism that... and you can do BCS theory, and you can do that in a way that does not even apparently break SU2 symmetry. In fact, I'm going to argue an important point.
Spin current, then the gauge field coupled to spin current must be a vector field.
Yes.
It's not.
Yes. Okay. So this is just the temporal part of that gauge field, right? So you can write this whole thing with the Hamiltonian, and what you find is that V mu.
No, internal is this.
It's like a Abelian polarization, and I suppose you may be able to recover the SU2 symmetry later if you're looking at it.
So this does nothing here breaks SU2 symmetry. In fact, I'm going to rely on that.
It worked pretty hard to recover. Yeah. No, you might.
Yeah, so you're doing things exactly or assured of SU2 symmetry. Otherwise, you have, I mean, once you start making approximations, you got to be careful about not doing things that violate SU2.
No, simple,
if you think SU2 is that important, right?
there is an easy plane. Well,
do you know part of what you're saying that AMU is not manifest? Is that what you're getting?
You mean that A, I think it's a V2 field.
So it's not massless. Is that what you're saying?
If you replace it by muon, then you it is massless. No, it is, okay. It's not massless.
So that's all that we need. So I'm going to argue now that V mu, when I integrate out fermions, acquires mass, and this is simply Meissner effect. U1 gauge symmetry is broken. On the other hand, since this A mu field couples to the spin 3 current, the SU2 symmetry is not broken in a superconductor, and therefore this field remains massless. And that's why it will have profound consequences for our fermions.
Now I'm really confused. We're in a superconducting state, and we've got a new massless mode?
Yes.
What's that massless mode?
This A mu.
No, this is supposed to be a vanilla D-wave superconductor. This
started with a D-wave superconductor, you didn't have that mode when you were in this
V2. Of course, this is a D-wave superconductor with vortices in it.
Okay.
And this mode, strictly speaking, comes from
vortices
having...
Vortices unbound, or are they bound to pairs?
No. They're unbound.
But
they're unbound.
Not a superconductor.
Once they're unbound, it's of course not a superconductor. So, yes.
The Cartesian mode is the one that works different Cartesian vortices. There's another U1 field which impacts the vortices impact another U1 field which mediates the works different Cartesian vortices. That U1 field is the Cartesian mode. This A is the Z2 field. There are two fields here.
Okay, strictly speaking, you're absolutely right. If we, Jinwoo, let me say something. It's my talk today. if you kept the Z2 field associated with vortices, then that would be a massless mode. If you can.
I just want to say this has nothing to do with the massless mode in the superconductor.
Look, Jinwoo, you're confusing me. We all agree there's this, space mode, which is probably what you're referring to, which gives that to log interaction.
No.
He's talking about something completely different. I mean, he claims it's a new massless mode, not the phase mode.
Oh, no, that's...
Yeah, so this V mu is just the usual superfluid velocity, and the fact that it becomes massive in a superconducting phase is a Meissner effect in the Meissner phase, or it tells me that vortices interact logarithmically above the critical temperature. Now, this is what is new in this theory, is that this A mu field associated with the differences between up and down vortices, and since it couples to spin density and spin 3 current, if you integrate out fermions, you cannot possibly get a mass to this gauge field.
Where, at what point did you assume that you were the unbound, the vortex pairs?
I did not assume that yet.
So, how do I know I'm not in the superconductor?
I don't know which phase we're in.
That's
the superconductor.
In superconducting phase, the vortices pair up, and this phase also becomes massive. This field also becomes massive. So as you go,
the frequency that says that in the superconductor, you have pairs more than you have massless.
Right. So this means.
Okay. I'm not making myself clear. What I'm talking about here is a mean field superconductor. So the whole phase below the T star is considered as a mean field superconductor. And when you integrate out fermions in that phase, then that will give you mass to V mu. And this means physically that vortices will interact logarithmically. That's how you get logarithmic interaction between vortices. That's a physical Meissner effect. In the Meissner phase...
In the pseudo-gap phase?
No. In the pseudo-gap phase...
You don't have Meissner effect there.
Of course you don't have Meissner effect. That's what I'm telling you. What you get is logarithmically interacting vortices. That's what corresponds to mass term, right? So you will have a term that goes like Vs squared with a prefactor rho. Okay? So you have locally superfluid density, and that's what these experiments above TC show us, and that will lead to logarithmic interaction between vortices. And the point here that I'm making is that A nu will not acquire mass above TC, but will acquire mass below TC because there is no unbound vortex, anti-vortex pairs. Everything is in pairs, so this will be a gapped excitation. So that's the difference.
Okay.
understand the logic a little bit. So
okay, that's
there,
good.
There's sort of two, at least formally, you have somehow two sources for the effective action for these A's.
Yes.
One is from integrating out these fermions here.
Yes.
And the statement on this transparency is that if I do that integral, I'll not generate a mass term for A.
Precisely. Yes, 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 yes.
In the previous transparency, you had something which I assume came from some Debye-Huppel-like approximation for vortices, right, and anti-vortices, which gave a Maxwell term with 1 over a vortex density.
Precisely, and yes, yes,
density
yes.
If density goes to 0, that blows
precisely.
Up.
Precisely, yes, yes,
like
yes, yes, yes.
Yes,
you said it, and since I'm trying to say precisely that, and I apologize to the audience that since I'm giving this talk for the first time, I'm not being completely clear about this. So, so is this now at
well,
least somewhat
I'm
acceptable?
I'm still slightly confused. So, when the vortices are confined together, what makes one of them be an up and the other be a down?
When they are confined together, then they are not there even. You just don't care about them. And they acquire some, both of these gauge fields have some large mass and we can forget about them. And we have just the BCS superconductor. And that you can see from this bare term, as Leon nicely saved me here. This bare term, which comes just from the measure integration, has in the denominator the free density of vortex, anti-vortex defects. So when you go below the transition temperature, these denominators just blow up, signaling that these fields become massive. That's the whole physics. Now, the point that I'm making is that upon integration...
It's not a conserved quantity, right?
Pardon me?
The vortex number is not conserved. That's...
But the, in some sense, you can define number...
Yeah, okay. I just want to make sure it's the total...
Yeah.
Some of the positive
magnitude. Yeah. So what I'm arguing now that even in a pseudo-gap phase where this bare action does not generate any mass, upon integrating out fermions, V mu will acquire mass, which translates to into logarithmic interaction between vortices, while A mu remains a massless mode because this global SU2 symmetry is unbroken.
And it's really a mode? I mean, it has dynamics?
Yes, it has dynamics, and I will show you how that comes about.
But there is no physical Meissner effect.
In pseudo-gap phase, of course, there is not. And the fact that V mu is massive translates to logarithmic interaction between vortices. This term here, rho times integral of Vs squared, in the superconducting phase, this gives you Meissner effect. In the normal phase, this is just an XY model and leads to logarithmic interaction between vortices. That's the standard.
How does the action of the electromagnetic field couple to any of this? Yeah. I mean, just so that I understand.
Real stiffness.
Well, that was on the previous transparency.
Yeah, it may have been, but I mean...
See, the superconductivity is in this model, in the pseudo-gap phase, is destroyed by fluctuating vortex-anti-vortex pairs. So you apply a twist across your system, and you immediately unbind vortex-anti-vortex pair. That's how you know you're not superconducting. But there is no Meissner effect. The field can penetrate without a problem.
Right.
Okay, so that's the physics of it. And I don't want to go through the algebra at this point because I still have a few more points to make. Okay, so if you just let me, I can finish this in a flash and show you some nice things. Okay, so now, what I say is that in both superconducting and pseudo-gap phase, my Doppler field is gapped. So I can safely integrate it out and it will just renormalize my constants. But in a pseudo-gap phase, I cannot easily integrate out my Doppler field. And I now concentrate on low energy degrees of freedom and linearize my Hamiltonian close to 4 nodes. And what I end up with is 4 Dirac Lagrangians associated with 4 nodes, where psi is now just a linearized fermion at low energy, and I observe that my covariant derivative A mu couples to momentum in this Dirac language as a real electromagnetic field would couple to a real Dirac fermion in high energy physics. It just has minimal coupling to to my low energy Dirac fermions, although of course it does not contain any of the real electromagnetic field in my superconductor.
Is psi minimally coupled to the real electromagnetic field? That is
no.
It's not. It's a neutral.
Yeah. This now is a neutral. Neutral theory, right? And this, if you just look at this, and L naught is now my bare Lagrangian, which just has a Maxwell stiffness. Now,
have you integrated all of your charge degrees of freedom, or this just the spin sector of the theory?
Okay, so I have integrated out the Doppler gauge field, which contains the electromagnetic field, and I could do that.
This is a product of the sub boson and the psi.
How can you recreate the electron operator?
Yeah, so the up goes on each di phi up that's still left somewhere. What do you do to that?
I haven't done anything to that. I mean, this is just a transform.
Which is also coupled in the same gate.
No, you said that it was massive.
Yes.
So that means there's a charge gap.
No.
Is that right?
No, that simply means that I have vortices logarithmically interacting among each other. That's all that it means. And it also means that I can just integrate out that field and...
Are we in an insulator or a superconductor?
We're in
the superconductor. No. The partial sector of the theory, what is...
This seems to go with a different phase in which you don't get exponential interactions.
Marcel, aren't those size just your gauge transform?
Yes, these are my topological fermions. These are just electrons which transform the way their phases.
No, but the charge is something else.
But the charge isn't here. I thought you said the charge fields were massive.
Which charge fields?
Well, phi was the only thing that carries charge anymore.
Yes, and that was massive, so I integrated that out.
Does that mean it's an insulator? That's the question. No,
it cannot be an insulator.
Well, fermion is two parts. One is a spin down, another is a charger.
The electron has two parts.
Right. And that guy, the charging part has a guy. Spin down part is guided, but the convolute still has a gap. So it's an insulator.
Okay, I disagree with that, but I must admit I haven't thought about that deeply, so I cannot answer this question. Yes.
Yeah, simple technical dumb question. How would you calculate single particle Green's function spectrum?
Okay, that's what I'm going to do, and that's going to be another point of contention. But let me proceed just a little bit further. I'm almost at the end, and then maybe we can discuss this. Okay, so this looks to me like a quantum electrodynamics in 2+1 dimensions, and this actually people studied in the past. If you look in the literature, a number of people actually studied this in various physical contexts. There's a group with Aitchinson and co-workers. There's Kim, Lee, and Wen who studied this in context of SU2 theory. And then there's older paper by high energy theorists who took this as a toy model for chiral symmetry breaking in QCD. And some of these people noted that this leads to marginal fermi liquid phenomenology for the fermionic excitations. Yes?
I know you didn't want to talk to the charge sector, but presumably these up bosons, down bosons, would also be coupled in the same gauge field, little a, with some coupling of order 1. Okay. Now, one may have thought that if you're getting out of the suitcase, there were cold creating vortices, HCO2 things, that gauge field would then induce the interaction between that gauge field and the induced by that gauge field between the up goes on and the up on the up side part would be such that it can find these two. But we're not going to worry about that issue at all.
No, I'm not.
So you're going to assume that you're not getting confinement somehow?
No, I'm assuming I'm not getting any confinement anywhere.
Will you be explaining at least an outline why this gauge theory gives rise to a marginal film?
Yes, that's precisely what I'm hoping to get to in this particular transparency. So now I take that as my model for pseudo-gap region, and I ask what are the properties of this QED3. And first thing that I can calculate is the effects of coupling to fermions on this baryon propagator. And you know, I simply sum up the bare piece plus fermion bubbles. And this is a known calculation. What I obtain is for this propagator, it goes like 1 over Q. And this is the thing that is special for to a D-wave superconductor in 2 plus 1 dimensions or QED3. There is no length scale. So this just goes as 1 over Q. And at some higher Q, I will start seeing this bare term, which goes like Q squared. But at low energies, this is the leading behavior. And this is where the seed of this marginal fermi-liquid becomes first apparent. You have no length scale, no energy scale for this propagator. So then I ask myself, what is the fermion self-energy?
Sorry, that was just doing the bubble sum?
Yes. And again, I will comment on why that might be a good approximation, and people have worried about doing a better job, but I'm just doing the simplest thing I can imagine, because even that shows some nice properties. So now I calculate the self-energy simply by calculating this diagram with a dressed baryon propagator. G naught is simply inverse of this Dirac form factor here. And again, by simple power counting almost, I can get this. And all calculations are simple at T equals 0 and V delta and equals to VF. So this is an isotropic limit. And again, I will comment on why this is appropriate in some sense and the extensions of that. Now, here comes what is interesting. What I get for self-energy is, again, this Dirac fermion form factor, which is the same as in the Green's function, times a log of some high energy cutoff, which comes from, say, maximum gap, divided by the size of my three momentum. So Q is my three momentum, Q0 is just imaginary frequency. Now, I want to see whether this gives me any damping, and I think this is what at this point I started to be somewhat interested in this whole thing, and I found this. When you do analytic continuation, of course omega turns to minus omega squared, and you can check when this gives you any imaginary piece, any quasi-particle damping. And of course this log gives you imaginary part when the argument of the square root becomes negative. In other words, when omega squared is bigger than Vf squared Q squared. And so in the Q omega plane, the self-energy will have imaginary part only in this shaded region here. So when omega is larger than Vf times vector Q. Now, what this means is that if I plot And of course, note that I have marginal fermi-liquid form for this self-energy. It's proportional to omega, although it's this MFL with a star, which means that you know I have some additional structure to this. It also depends on momentum, and it has this theta function telling me that I have imaginary part only in this region here. Now, notice what this will do. If I plot a spectral function of this topological fermion, and I plot it at Fermi energy, which is here, omega equals zero, and I plot it as a function of momentum, then I get something incredibly sharp, because there is no imaginary part along this line. On the other hand, if I now plot at Q equals zero, which is a Fermi momentum as a function of energy, then I get something very broad because there's imaginary part along this axis. Now, this is something that people see experimentally in ARPAS, as you probably well know. This is the results of Vala and coworkers, which became somewhat famous. So this is the scan along the nodal direction and energy, this two-dimensional scan. And if they scan along this axis, which is momentum, then they get something sharp. So MDCs, momentum distribution curves, are sharp experimentally, while EDCs are broad. And I want you to focus on these gray lines, which correspond to a physics above the critical temperature in that pseudo-gap regime. So that's a general feature that people find experimentally, and this theory gives that in sort of the very leading order approximation.
Were these results for underdoped or optimally doped?
These results were for optimally doped, yes.
Oh, I thought you weren't going to talk about the region above the spin gap.
What is that?
Well, I asked you earlier and asked you whether it's relevant to the marginal Fermi-Liquid behavior above the spin gap.
Okay.
You said no, it isn't, and yet you just showed some data.
I showed you some data, and I'm just arguing that maybe this is still under the T-star line. See, I can show you some evidence that even in slightly overdoped BISCO, there is a pseudo gap above TC. This is tunneling data.
Marcel, you calculate the electron spectral function or the spectral function of these neutral.
This is a spectral function of these neutral.
How does it become?
Where's the charge?
I will address that in a second. Okay, this is something that I thought about actually, and I have an argument why this is the right thing to do. But just let me show two more transparencies and then I address that question. Okay, so that is what experiment tells us, and you know, again, the working hypothesis is that somehow those experiments are still in the pseudo gap regime. And you know, that may not be the case. And in that case I'm toast.
But it might be in
phase
fluctuation regime.
I'm just bringing to your attention this interesting property of this theory, and that's all I'm doing.
But your theory, this thing works only at one point, right? Whereas the experiment, this feature works over a line
in
Fermi circle.
Yes, and this will be preserved. This will be preserved. I'm just doing precisely that. So if I now plot, this is a cut. I'm cutting in momentum along the nodal direction, perpendicular to the Fermi surface, and this is my energy. And so this is now the spectral function of this topological fermion, and obviously it has this property that when I cut along momentum, I will get something sharp. On the other hand, when I cut as a function of energy, I will get something with a power law tail. Now, if I go away from the node, what simply happens is that I see the gap here. So this is for QY, if you wish, slightly removed. So this on this previous diagram, this would correspond to cut along, say, this line number 2. So I see this produces a gap, but the argument remains the same. If I cut like this, then I get something sharp as an MDC. If I cut like that, I will get something broad. And let me just show you one of such cuts.
So you will tell us why it's okay for you to compare.
Yes, I will. Just, you know, last transparency, and then I will tell you everything. Okay, so this is the example of one such cut right at the nodal point as a function of energy. I get something that is a power law. As a function of momentum, I get something that is incredibly sharp. And you see, right at the nodal point, this would just be a delta function. I have broadened a little bit. But the point is, I have broadened this and that by precisely the same amount. Here, I'm broadening a delta function. Here, I'm broadening something that is already a power law. So if I didn't broaden, then this would just diverge at zero energy, and it would not show as nicely. So this is just one example what this theory gives you very naturally. Now, I represent one transparency and then answer your question. And this is my last transparency. So all I have done is this very simplest approximation for the QED3, where I consider T equals 0 and isotropic gap. Plus, I have only used a very simple perturbation theory. Now, in some of these papers that I cited before, people have worried about this, and one can formalize this log result as a leading term in large N expansion, and then one can go beyond that and re-sum such expansion. And what people find, generally, is that this log is replaced by a small power. With a small by power law with a small power, which is some number like this. Although it depends on which paper you look in for precise number here. But I think the argument is that the log is replaced by a power law with small power, and that will preserve all these nice features that I just showed you about the spectral function. Now, away from isotropic limit, we can show that this log in self-energy survives. However, what happens is that this Dirac form factor acquires some renormalized velocities, and unfortunately all these calculations become incredibly messy when you lose this relativistic invariance of the Dirac equation. And the same thing applies for finite temperature calculations. Everything algebra becomes impenetrable when you replace your imaginary time integrals by sums. But we can again show that in the limit of temperature being much larger than omega q, the self-energy is linear in temperature, its imaginary part, just like in marginal liquid, although we are unable at the moment to find the exact crossover function. That seems to be quite a challenge. And so this suggests a marginal Fermi liquid behavior of that particular form. Okay, this is basically all that I have to say. And I'm now going to argue. So this is my conclusions, which you may read. And I'm going to argue why is it that I'm allowed to proclaim that topological fermions, why am I allowed to look at topological fermions, their spectral function associated with experiment? So imagine.
So the charge sector has been doing this whole time. Are we in an insulator or a superconductor?
We're not in insulator. We're at finite temperature, so we're certainly not in a superconductor.
So you have a temperature that t equals zero, right? So we're not finite temperature.
Okay, yeah, so that's another confusing point for which I apologize. The whole conceptual part of this has been done at finite temperature. It's just that when I calculate the actual self-energy, I can only exactly evaluate it at t equals zero. I can make some approximations at finite temperature. So I showed you this behavior at t equals zero, but it will translate to finite temperature that we checked. It's just that I don't have explicit form that I can give you. That's all there is. So we are at finite temperature.
Well, asked you to consider doing this at zero temperature.
Then one would have to worry about other things, like, of course, vortices see electrons as magnetic fluxes in this dual language, and so then you come to this problem that the transition of unbinding HC over T2E vortices, the quantum phase transition, is highly non-trivial one. So we choose not to worry about that at this moment. But let me answer the question: why is it that I claim that ARPES in fact measures spectral function of topological fermion rather than electron. Okay, so imagine I have a two-dimensional system, and imagine for the beginning that it's non-interacting two-dimensional electron gas. Okay, I measure spectral function by ARPES, and my electron goes to detector, and what I have to see is just a sharp delta function because it's a free electron gas. Okay. No question there. Now, I have to realize now that saying that ARPES measures spectral function is actually a completely crazy statement, because spectral function is an object which is not gauge invariant. So ARPES cannot possibly measure spectral function. It measures some gauge invariant current correlator, which in certain approximation becomes a spectral function, or in certain gauge becomes spectral function. Now, imagine I do the following thing. I go to a machine shop in the basement and borrow a piece of Dirac string. Okay? Dirac string is something that has 2 pi flux, but it's infinitely thin. Okay? I take a Dirac string and start it from infinity and wind it through my system in such a way that it pierces my 2D electron gas in random locations, and then take it back to infinity. Okay. Now notice that this corresponds precisely to doing this singular gauge transformation on my 2D electron gas. I just put 2 pi fluxes inside it. Now, I know that winding this Dirac string through the system cannot change the outcome of this experiment, because Dirac string, as Dirac pointed himself in 1936, cannot be observable in any experiment, right? So I now made this singular gauge transformation. I the spectral function itself, if I were to calculate it inside of that 2D electron gas, would be completely incoherent because it would contain this correlator of random random phase-phase correlator, which would be convoluted with my single electron spectral function. But ARPAS still measures the original sharp spectral function. So this is the argument. And in the superconductor, we're doing precisely the same thing. We're just making our life easier by doing the singular gauge transformation. And and what we're measuring is the spectral function of the topological fermion.
So you've added a quantum, a charge quantum number to that system. When you do your photo emission experiment, you're looking at excitations of spin a half and charge E.
Okay.
And you got to do something with that charge E.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's other, you can look at this in terms of matrix elements.
Which is topological fermion.
Which the topological fermion doesn't care. Exactly.
No, no, so let
you
me ask you.
You
do not agree with this argument, are you?
I mean, that gets the outgoing photoelectron gets phase shifted by exactly the same things, presumably.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean you don't have to take into account what the charge degrees of freedom are doing in the system. You do.
But
you are measuring the one particle spectral function.
No, you're not.
Well,
you're not in
charge
E out of the system.
So but it's precisely the same. I cannot think of that experiment just in two-dimensional geometry. I have to consider what happens when the electron leaves the system.
Where's the communications here? So I think they'll stipulate to this. They're worried about the charge parts of the theory that they were asking about before, not about this particular thing. Is that right?
Oh, but that was a Santel's question. That why do I measure? Why am I allowed to talk about the topological fermion as opposed to actual electron?
It doesn't have a charge.
The question what Steve just said. So in this experiment, you're talking about an electron.
Yes.
Which carries charge E and spin half.
Yes.
And now what you've calculated is the spectral function of this topological fermion which carries charge zero and spin half. Right? So you calculated the rate of transitions to a state which is differs from the ground state by having an extra spin half but no extra charge.
No, I just disagree with that. In my superconducting state, I just have vortices and anti-vortices. And what I in my pseudo gap state, I have vortices, anti-vortices, right? And what I choose to do is make my life easier by winding a Dirac string through them, so that I can transform away this phase.
So that's your technique for calculation.
Yes.
The two states that you're connecting together by your by the topological fermion operator, those two states carry the same physical charge. They only differ in their spin. While the initial and final states in the real experiment differ both in the spin quantum number and the charge quantum number.
Okay, yeah, so I haven't thought about this way, so I cannot answer that question. The way I thought about this is this way. And
look, what happens there, you're measuring a product of two green functions, one for the outgoing electron and one for the electron in the hole left behind. When you put this through, you make a gauge transformation on both of them. Okay, something complicated happens.
Yes.
But you might as well. So, okay, you could do that. That doesn't say that the phase of the thing in the plane doesn't matter. That whatever you're doing in this gauge transformation, you do the same thing to the outgoing electron, so they cancel. So you get a gauge invariant answer. So you might as well work in the gauge where the gauge field is zero. And then all you're measuring in a sudden approximation is the single particle green function. The gauge invariance takes care of itself.
Okay, but I'm claiming that I'm doing precisely the same thing.
You are
going to stay in part of the electron gas.
What?
Well, there's 2D electron gas.
It would. You get a singular gauge transformation on the outgoing photoelectron also. You get the same answer.
If you have amiable gapless in the superconducting phase, I mean, in the superconducting phase, everything sounds okay.
In the superconducting phase.
Imagine you're just to the shortest of the phase coherence length.
But you can't because these are vortices.
Yeah, yeah. In the superconducting phase, it's a massive field.
It's massive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's okay because he's got those things. I mean, the real electron wave creation operator is going to be your topological fermion creation operator times an e to the I phi sub sigma.
Yes.
So when I calculate the correlation functions, since you're Hamiltonian factorized, it's going to be a product of a correlator for the e to the I phis and a correlator for the topological
precisely.
Fermion.
Yes, yes, yes.
You've calculated the correlator for the for the topological fermion.
Yes.
But you have to convolute it with the correlator.
Okay, Steve.
Phase.
Okay, Steve. But precisely, can I answer to that?
You do
Steve,
it,
can
you
I answer
do it
to that?
In some gauge.
But that would even that would only be legitimate if the spin charge separation.
Right.
Well,
right.
And
right.
It is
there is.
So let's not worry about.
Hey, guys, may I say something? May I say something? Precisely the same argument that Steve eloquently just presented to us would imply that this situation for free electron gas would give you completely incoherent Green's function. It's true.
No, you have to, if you want to do it, you have to do the calculation consistently. You have to write the Green function for the photoelectron in the same gauge as the Green function for the photogenerated hole. Okay, so all you'll get if you do that is that the outgoing photoelectron, where in writing down these formulas, we've assumed that it's simple, that it's just, you know, 1 times delta of omega minus epsilon k. But if you do this gauge, the outgoing photoelectron will also have some complicated phase factors, which will exactly cancel the phase factors you generated here. If you work in any one gauge, you'll get a consistent answer.
He's trying to say that they can seem precisely the term you want to call the loop.
What?
He's saying that they will cancel precisely the terms you want to convolute.
Yeah,
no,
yeah, that's what I'm saying. Look, Steve.
It's the charge sector. It's physical. It's not a gauge argument.
No, no, but you see, this argument should apply not only to free electron gas, but any interacting electron gas, right?
It does. The point is, the calculation that says that the ARPIS measures the one particle Green function in the plane, that calculation is done in the gauge where A is zero. You want to do it in a different gauge, it will tell you, it will measure the correlation function in the plane times the gauge phase factor from the outgoing photoelectron in such a way that you'll get a gauge invariant answer.
Yes.
It is a two-particle thing.
Yes.
But the gauge that you pick in your Dirac string is a red herring. Doesn't affect the answer at all.
Yeah, but I still claim that I'm doing precisely the same thing in a superconductor. And yeah, so. Yeah, you see, you're right. If I were to convolute this with a phase-phase correlator, then I would get something that is completely incoherent. I would get some Gaussian for my spectral function.
Yeah, but he's saying
something like that.
He's saying you have to do more work, right? You have to actually. I mean, do you have to worry about the whole part too? There's actually, you know, because they don't actually measure even a single electron thing. You know, you actually measure something that has a whole left component.
Yeah,
that's
right. So you measure the probabilities that you get an electron out with a given.
What are we supposed to do
with that? Then lunchtime again.
And you make the sudden approximation that you could have.